That's Toumani Diabaté, the magnificent choral player from Mali, with a melody dedicated to and named after his good friend and mentor and outstanding fellow Malian musician, the late Alifa Katouré, known for his traditional Malian music as well, but also as the blues man of the entire continent. Alifa Katouré died in 2006. And this is from Diabaté's first solo album titled The Mandé Variations, released in 2008. Diabaté, by the way, is a descendant of a long line of hereditary musicians called griots. He is the 72nd generation in his patrilineal line. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, April the 30th, and much ground to cover today, so we'll get started. First up, Detroit's governor-appointed city manager, Kevin Orr, went to Corton for the second day today in Lansing, hoping to convince state legislators to release $350 million in tax-sharing revenue that Governor Rick Snyder had promised the beleaguered city, and which actually it has been owed for a long time. Without the money, Orr's ambitious restructuring plan to exit bankruptcy by the fall is doomed. Correspondent Abayomi Azikiwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, is with us now, and he's been covering Detroit for quite some time, as you know, here at Lead Stories. Thanks, Abayomi. You're on the air today again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with that very small snippet there. The city manager is trying to make the trying to be likable and well liked at the state level. What's going on? How is it working?
Well, he has been in Lansing for the last 2 days lobbying the conservative, Republican, multi-billionaire-oriented state legislature to pass a bill of merely $350 million to assist this whole restructuring process in the city of Detroit. There is a split among the conservatives in Lansing over this issue. One person last week, who is the Speaker of the State Representative House, said that the unions have to kick in money. And, of course, that's not the position of the State Senate Majority Leader, and neither is it the position of Governor Rick Snyder. So he's trying to, of course, wrap up the state legislative portion of this deal so they can attempt to ram it through in the weeks and months to come, so they won't be delayed in this whole so-called restructuring process of the city of Detroit.
Well, what's about the news that 14 employee unions have reached some kind of a tentative deal on five-year collective bargaining agreements with the emergency manager?
That's been publicized in the corporate media over the last couple of days. And they're not talking about it, meaning the union leadership, the AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County and Municipal Employees. District 25, which represents a huge chunk of the municipal employees in Detroit, had a meeting, public meeting last night, and they would not discuss when asked by retirees, at least one activist retiree in the audience, had they made a deal. And what is the terms of the deal? They refused to acknowledge that a deal had been made or what the terms of the deal was. So it remains to be seen. Now, today there was a hearing, and it's still going on down at the federal courthouse, over an effort by Bill Schuette, who is the attorney general for the state of Michigan, to have dismissed a constitutional challenge to Public Act 436, which is the emergency manager or dictator law. And a lot of people showed up for this hearing. The courtroom was packed. They had to close down the designated courtroom and move to a bigger courtroom. And there were also demonstrations outside. All of the people I talked to outside the courtroom and those who were inside the courtroom said they plan on voting no on this so-called plan adjustment. Ballots are going to be going out in a few days, but people don't have the information. They don't have the details. So, of course, they are saying they could not vote yes if they don't have all the details involved in this purported grand bargain that's been much touted in the corporate media over the last several weeks.
So there's a lot riding on this visit, this second day in Lansing, trying to get that money, to pry loose the money, because Orr is facing a conference with the bankruptcy judge, Stephen Rhodes, on May the 15th. He's got to have something to suggest that there's some movement on his so-called plan, adjustment plan.
Yes, this is a strategy. They want to bully and intimidate as many people as they can so they can make it appear as if a significant portion of the so-called creditors are on board with this plan of adjustment, which keeps changing. There's been several versions of it over the last several weeks, and people just do not have the specific information in regard to what's all involved in this plan. We were talking today outside the federal court with retirees. They're saying we don't have the details. It was reported last week that they had all of a sudden found money or come up with a different calculation for the pensions. They're saying now the police and fire retirees will not have to take any cuts in their paychecks, and that the general retiree pension recipients will only receive a 4.5% cut. Well, what is all of this about? They were claiming just up until recently that the pension system was underfunded by $3.5 billion. The city was forced into bankruptcy, an emergency manager was appointed. So what was the idea of appointing an emergency manager, filing bankruptcy, if there's not a necessity of cutting pensions substantially? Also, they announced, as you mentioned, about this tentative deal. They're claiming they're going to restore the 10% pay cut that the municipal employees have been living with now over the last 3 years. Where did that money come from? So people are raising a lot of questions about the whole process. If the city is really running out of cash, if the pension system is actually underfunded by $3.5 billion, then all of a sudden where is this money coming from? So these are the questions that people are asking. And at the same time, they have clauses within the plan of adjustment that suggest that there could be so-called, quote, clawbacks, unquote, dealing with the annuity portion of the pensions, where they can say that if you were paid too much into your annuity, or if you were not given proper representation in terms of the financial status of your annuity account, that in fact you could lose money if it was proven that you were given money that you weren't necessarily entitled to. Then they could take this out of your pension check. And they even suggested last Thursday that some people's pensions could be completely eliminated. So these are the tactics they're using. It's a carrot and a stick approach. On the one hand, they're saying, yeah, we're putting together this package. The state, the philanthropic organizations, we're recalculating how the pension compensations will be evaluated. And in fact, there won't be substantial cuts to the pensions. The workers will be given back their 10%, and so on and so forth. But there's a lot of unanswered questions, and I don't think it's enough to get people in mass to vote in favor of this so-called plan of adjustment. And the ballots are going to be going out, as I mentioned before, early next month in May. But there's going to be a major hearing. The trial is going to start now. They're saying July 24th. It was July 16th. It may be pushed back again. So it's a lot at stake for the 1% here in this area.
Mm. Speaking of en masse, tomorrow is May the 1st. I understand there's a big deal happening tomorrow in terms of protesting. What's happening?
Well, yes, about 35 different organizations have come together to call for a no business as usual day in the city of Detroit. They're calling for people to refrain from going to work, from going to school, from purchasing consumer goods. And people are going to be gathering at UAW Local 600 beginning at 8 a.m. For ecumenical gathering. And then at 11 o'clock, there's going to be a car caravan through the southwest side and down to Hart Plaza in the heart of downtown, where there will be a rally from noon to 1:30, and then a march through downtown, through the financial district, past Chase Bank, Bank of America, all of the usual suspects, to the federal courthouse, to the penthouse at the Book Cadillac, where Kevin Orr is being put up to the tune of $4,200 a month on the taxpayer dime. And then, of course, people who still have objections, tomorrow's the deadline for filing the objections to the plan of adjustment. The last batch of those objections will be filed tomorrow at the federal courthouse. Then there's going to be a rally at Grand Circus Park, public park in downtown Detroit, which now purportedly is under the control of Dan Gilbert, the owner of Quicken Loans and other financial entities who has been given about 20 or 30 buildings in downtown Detroit. He's remaking downtown in his own image. So yes, there's a lot going on tomorrow, and people are mobilizing and preparing for these actions in Detroit. But the theme is no emergency manager, no business as usual. We want to preserve our pensions, our city assets, and, of course, the jobs and salaries of the working people of this town.
Well, from your perspective, because you're an organizer for the Workers' World Party in Detroit, from your perspective, is the grassroots as hopeful, or are they as energetic in these protests as you would think that they should be?
Oh, most definitely. And more people are coming out. I think the people that are coming out are representative of the majority sentiment here in the city. And people are angry. I mentioned what happened in terms of my discussions today with retirees and others who showed up for this effort in the court today on the part of the state attorney general to dismiss the constitutional challenges to the dictator law, Public Act 436. People are saying they're not going to vote in favor of this plan of adjustment if they do not have guarantees, if they do not have the information needed to make a reasonable decision. The plan keeps changing. There are all types of hidden clauses and conditionalities, which people are very, very skeptical about. And, you know, who's going to vote to take money away from their own checks? Who's going to vote to disperse public assets if, in fact, they don't have the proper information to make an informed decision? So that's where we are right now. I think that there's a lot of discontent in the city about what's going on, and this discontent is going to be building despite all the hype that people are reading around the country and the corporate media, that this thing is being wrapped up, that the pensioners have won, that the municipal employees have won. In fact, the situation is still very much up in the air.
Well, Abayomi, thank you so much for this update. We depend on you for giving such panoramic and thorough reports from Detroit, and especially from the grassroots perspective, because so many people are not in tune with what is actually happening on the ground level. We get reports which seem to be very different from the reports that you give us here at Lead Story. So I want to thank you so much for being a great, great grassroots reporter. And, of course, that is a fantastic compliment to you.
Yes, and you're most definitely welcome, and happy May Day. I want to wish all the workers and everyone out there a happy May Day tomorrow, and they should be out in defense of working people here in this country and around the world.
Thank you. Thanks again.
All right, thank you.
After this short break, we come back to talk about this tiny country taking on nine big ones right after this. Republic of the Marshall Islands, a nation of 68,480 people spread across 24 low-lying coral atolls comprising more than 1,100 islands and islets, today files actions in the International Court of Justice in The Hague against Russia, Britain, France, China, Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea, saying they have all violated the nuclear non-proliferation treaties and have created long-lasting ecological and human disasters in areas where they have tested nuclear weapons. Telling us about this is Rick Wayman, Director of Programs for the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, and he's going to tell us about the legal battle. Thank you so much, Rick, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about this fight. It's a mighty fight. A tiny little nation is going up against some pretty big nations, the Nuclear Nine, as they're called. What is the chance that they will prevail?
Well, there is a chance, and they fully expect to prevail because, as you said, it's a small nation going up against some quite strong military might. Some call it a David and Goliath story, except in this case, the Marshall Islands don't have a slingshot like David did in the biblical story. All they have on their side is the law, and so we do believe that they've given a fair hearing in the courts, that they will indeed prevail.
What is the purpose of the suit?
Well, the purpose of the suit is holding the nuclear-armed nations to account for their failure to negotiate in good faith for the elimination of nuclear weapons. It's something that was required in a treaty called the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which entered into force 44 years ago. Article 6 of that treaty requires both an end to the nuclear arms race and nuclear disarmament, and these things clearly have not happened. Here we are 44 years later in exactly the same position we were when the treaty entered into force originally.
The president of the Marshall Islands had said at the United Nations that the United States basically has a lot of unfinished business, especially as it relates to the Marshall Islands. What is the nature of this unfinished business?
Sure. Well, first thing, just to be clear, these lawsuits do not relate to that unfinished business that he was referring to. The lawsuits are strictly a breach of contract lawsuit for failure to implement the treaty. But what he was talking about is a very sad and terrible legacy that the United States left behind in the Marshall Islands. The U.S. tested 67 nuclear weapons in the Marshall Islands between 1946 and 1958. The biggest of those weapons was 1,000 times the strength of the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. So, excuse me. So, there's a long legacy of health problems. Many Marshall Islanders have been forced to relocate because their traditional areas of living are now radioactively contaminated. And so the unfinished business really is related to that terrible legacy, which will take many generations to fully deal with.
In light of this action being taken by the Marshall Islands, are there other nations in support of this small nation trying to take on the Big Nine? Have they come to its support at all on this measure?
Sure. Well, right now I'm actually speaking to you from the hallway of the United Nations. I'm at the Non-Proliferation Treaty Conference right now. And there have been a number of nations that have either privately or publicly expressed support in one way or another of what the Marshall Islands has done. This is a very big deal when it comes right down to it. And no other nation knew that it was coming until just 6 days ago. So there have been no other nations that have 100% committed just signing on in support or filing their own parallel lawsuits. But we are in discussions with numerous nations, and we are hopeful that others around the world will be inspired by the courage of the Marshall Islands and stand up and do the right thing by joining them.
Your organization, the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, has been monitoring, of course, nuclear nations and treaties, and certainly the breach of treaties all over the world. What would you say is of greatest concern right now with respect to the nuclear age?
Well, the biggest concern is that there are still 17,000 nuclear weapons in the world. This is outrageous. It's 20 years after the end of the Cold War. We have no real use for these weapons. Scientific studies, which all of the nations are quite aware of, show that even a limited use of a portion of the existing nuclear stockpiles would cause what's called nuclear famine due to the smoke that would be released into the atmosphere. So in addition to the millions that would die through leveling of cities and the firestorms and the radioactive fallout, the smoke clouds that would cover prevent sunlight from reaching the earth would cause famine all around the world. And so even in a limited India and Pakistan nuclear exchange, that would affect all of us around the globe. And so the mere existence of nuclear weapons is the concern. There's no way around it. They require absolute perfection in order to make sure that they're never used by accident or design. And as we all know, humans are not perfect. And one mistake with these could be too late for us all. And that's why the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation is working tirelessly to address this threat. And that's why we're very happy to be associated with brave countries like the Marshall Islands that are also willing to stand up to this threat.
Are all nine, the nuclear nine, as you're calling them, are all nine equally truculent, or have some of those nations been amenable to taking measures to get rid, if it's even possible to get rid of nuclear weapons?
Well, different nations treat that issue quite differently. You'll hear from a nation like the United Kingdom, for example, which will say, oh, we only have 160 nuclear weapons. Look at the U.S. and Russia. They have many thousands. So once the U.S. and Russia get down to a small number, then maybe we can join in the negotiations. And Israel won't even admit that they have nuclear weapons, even though it's a well-known fact that they do. So different nations treat it differently, but under the law, they are all violating either the Non-Proliferation Treaty or, in the case of the four nuclear nations that have not signed that treaty, they're violating customary international law, which also requires them to negotiate nuclear disarmament.
Well, one of the issues, you know, I noted, of course, that this is being filed in the International Court of Justice. The United States does not necessarily recognize the jurisdiction of the International Court. So when an action is taken and lodged there at The Hague, what impact would it have? How could it compel the United States, which does not recognize the International Court, to abide by the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty?
Well, that's a great question, and unfortunately, the United States does not have to be compelled to sit in on that case in the International Court of Justice. And that's why the Marshall Islands chose specifically to file an additional lawsuit against the United States in U.S. Federal District Court. And that is a venue that the United States government cannot ignore. So the United States, one way or another, this case will be heard against them.
And from the other vantage point, other than nuclear weapons, is any consideration given to nuclear power plants, for example, or is this strictly on nuclear weapons?
Well, the lawsuits are strictly around nuclear weapons. There is one article in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Article 4, which says that signatories to the treaty have an inalienable right to the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, but that's totally unrelated to these lawsuits. That we wanted to focus on, the Marshall Islands wanted to focus on what they saw as the number one threat to humanity, which is nuclear weapons and the failure of nuclear armed states to disarm.
What are the hot spots right now?
Well, certainly what's going on in Ukraine is at the top of most people's minds. And given that in many ways the Russians and the United States are on different sides of that issue, give many people very rightful cause for concern. But the fact is the U.S. and Russia both have about 1,000 nuclear weapons each on hair trigger alert, ready to be fired within minutes of an order. So it could be something that goes off in a part of the world like Ukraine, where the U.S. and Russia are clearly set against one another in their positions, or it could be something that happens by accident. There have been cases in the past where one country's radar systems thought that they saw an incoming nuclear attack from the other nation. And it was really only by luck and the decision of one person not to press the button that we averted nuclear catastrophe. So it's not only the hotspots that we have to worry about, it's also mechanical failure and accident that we have to be very concerned about.
What you're attending this conference, what is the most significant development or outcome so far?
Well, the most significant thing that, in my opinion, is on Monday, at the opening day of the conference, the foreign minister of the Marshall Islands, Tony DeBroom, spoke in the opening plenary session to all of the delegates and most of the NGO representatives who are in attendance. And Tony is a survivor himself of the U.S. nuclear testing regime in the Marshall Islands. He personally witnessed the Castle Bravo nuclear explosion in 1954. That's the one I mentioned earlier that was 1,000 times the explosive yield of the Hiroshima bomb. And he brought this personal story to the room. He asked everyone in the room, we're here talking about nuclear weapons, but I want to know how many of you have personally witnessed a nuclear detonation? And with that question, he really brought his credibility to speak on this issue, and you could hear a pin drop in that room for the whole rest of his speech, where he outlined why the Marshall Islands chose to sue the U.S. and the other nuclear armed nations. It was very moving. It was followed by a thunderous applause from the NGO section of the room after his speech, which is pretty unprecedented in UN terms. Typically, things just happen very quietly and diplomatically around here. So it was very exciting to have the foreign minister bring that energy into the room and into the opening session of the conference.
And what resolutions are is the conference considering? At the end of this conference, what are the major resolutions that you think would be voted on?
Well, unfortunately, the way that the Non-Proliferation Treaty regime is structured, there is a review conference once every 5 years. So that's on the fifth year and the zero year of the decade. So the review conference is not until this time next year. What we're at now is just a preparatory committee meeting, which is basically, it's where they decide on the agenda for the next year. And really very little gets done. Countries tend to come to these events and deliver prepared statements. There's really no interactive debate. There's not even a whole lot of learning from one another. It is simply, for the most part, diplomats reading out their country's position. And So there's not a whole lot that looks like will happen. Perhaps the Marshall Islands action will encourage other nations to start demanding more, and really start demanding that in next year's review cycle, something positive actually happen. But that'll be the 45th year of this treaty being in effect, and we still have 17,000 nuclear weapons. So something needs to change, and the Marshall Islands is trying one tactic to make that change happen in the world.
Rick Wayman, thank you so much. Rick Wayman of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, thank you so much for joining us and giving us some information about this very important subject today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And for those who want to learn more, they can go to www.nuclearzero.org.
Just repeat that.
www.nuclearzero.org.
And zero is spelled out.
Yes, Z-E-R-O, nuclear, right. Z-E-R-O dot org.
Great. Thanks, Rick. We'll talk with you again soon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, a little bit more choral music, and I get back to Mr. Donald Sterling. Listening to PRN.FM, and I'm Utrice Lead. The program is Lead Stories, and I want to pick up from where I left off just yesterday on my introduction of a different way of looking at this so-called scandal that has been unfolding involving the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, Donald Sterling. Well, of course, you know what has happened. The NBA has come down, as they say, with a hammer. They fined him $2.5 million, the highest amount allowable under the rules of the NBA owners, from the NBA owner's manual. When you mess up, that's the highest amount that you could be charged, which for a billionaire is no money at all. He has been banned for life from having anything to do with basketball. And he is, of course, condemned for his racist statements and so forth. Well, for one thing, I think there's a lot of legal mileage here, not for the NBA, but for Don Sterling. I think there is I don't know that an organization could ban you or ban any person from going anywhere. I don't know. Maybe there's a special dispensation that they will have, but it will be tested, I'm sure. And all these other sanctions taken against it will be tested. This is not to say that I admire Mr. Sterling. I do not. But a couple of things have been troubling me about this case. And we talked about the stuff yesterday. We started talking. I don't want to retrace all of that. I imagine that if you're interested, just go back and get the podcast and you see where we went with it yesterday. But I want to talk about how these players, whether they realize it or not, they've been played. And, you know, this is a situation in which the charge essentially is racism. Now, it is not new. It really is not new. It has become new because of a tape of Don Sterling talking with his alleged girlfriend. And in the middle of all of that, of course, all the other things attached, you know, the seamy underside of it, the sex issue of it, the scandal and all of that stuff. All of that attaches to it, so it brings the story to the public attention as if it were new. But almost universally it is accepted that this man has had this pattern for a long time. And what I mean by the players getting played is they accepted the role that they shouldn't have taken on. Their job is not to rid the NBA of racism. That's the NBA's job. That's the organization's job. And this is one thing that bothers me a lot when we talk about racism, the idea being that the victims of racism, the people who are suffering because of it, also are expected to, again, tote another barge and lift another bale by taking responsibility for the rehabilitation or for the punishment of people who have committed these acts. The fact that Donald Sterling has been around for these many years, a known and serial racist, it is, to my mind, a very important question about where were the whites? Where was the organization? Why is it that black basketball players have to take on the responsibility of pointing it out and then become involved in the business of pressing for sanctions? They got played. You're not supposed to do that. This is the one time they should shut up. Have nothing to say except we're doing a lot of practicing, we're looking forward to the playoffs, and leave it at that. Because this is the organizational responsibility for refusing in all these times to really deal with it in a systemic fashion. And it does strike me as odd that the players would be so prominent in taking on this role. You are players. You are the employees of this man, okay? You belong to a union. Let the union handle that. You don't get to publicly fire your employer because it puts you in a very stupid position. But these kinds of anomalies are allowed because, in fact, my position is the NBA did not want and still does not want to go it alone. It needs company. It needs the sanction. It needs the approval, the good housekeeping seal of approval to say, I, as a white guy who heads up the NBA, I didn't do this alone. Yes, you're supposed to do it alone. You go alone on this one. That's your job. And all of the owners, the predominantly white circle of owners, it's their job to step forward. You haven't seen too many, have you? Where are they? Bring them forward and have them publicly disavow this colleague of theirs. But what did we see? We saw it as if, and that's going to be the narrative, it already is the official narrative, that the NBA commissioner, Adam Silver, took this action literally at the behest of blacks, when that's wrong. He should have been, the narrative should be, he took this action because it was necessary and warranted if he wants to take that position. But to have to, they need this thing that they constantly do of orchestrating the picture so that you're not left out there by yourself. You are intimating both visually and, for the television cameras and all that, and for the newspapers and people reporting, that he had company in this, and the blacks have sanctioned it, which is the stupidest move I've ever seen. Their job was to be so completely out of this, it ain't even funny. Have nothing to say. Let's see how the organization responds, and let the organization take 100% responsibility for the sanctions and or rehabilitation of one of their own. Now, when the black players were supposed to show up, they never did. And that was when one of their own Mr. Baylor, Elgin Baylor, who was a manager, had filed a lawsuit, and nobody was there to back him up. When he filed his lawsuit charging race and age discrimination because he was paid, only about $350,000 a year, and the person, the white male who was hired right after him, was paid something like in excess of $12 million, he couldn't find any players to say, we surround this man. We support this man. Now they're being trotted out as visual eye candy to surround the NBA commissioner and to take the job of explaining to the media how it is that their concerns, it's not about their concerns resulting in sanctions being taken against Donald Sterling. It should be the organization's standards. And that's all it needs to be. Shut up and leave it alone. Get out of the picture. You don't belong there. When it was time for you to speak up, you had nothing to say. When one of your own was absolutely being pilloried, absolutely being discriminated against by this organization, you had nothing to say. And if ever there was a valid case, that was it. But you ran for the hills. You took off. You made yourself scarce. All of a sudden now you have something to say. And this is a very vile pattern. And it is a surreptitious thing that organizations do. Because in their heart of hearts, if there were any other way to deal with it, they will try it because they really don't want the public responsibility of having to chastise anybody white publicly for being a racist. They're loath to do something like that. And the history of battling racism has been that the people who are suffering from it, the targets of it, are now supposed to take responsibility for making the situation whole. No, sir. It doesn't go that way. And somebody should have said, they have enough money among themselves to get proper advice. Shut up. And go about your business. Go practice and look forward to your games. Have nothing to say. This man had been allowed to be a festering sore, an oppressive presence, institutionally, for all these years. It means the organization condoned it. The only reason that it has come to this is that the press has made it such a big deal. They had to respond. And how are they going to respond? Well, they have to do something drastic and okay. But if I have to do something drastic, I am not going to do it by myself. I'll need you guys to stand with me. And what do? They do that, which basically undermines their own position. You are employees of this man. You should have nothing to do, unless you're suing, you should have nothing to do with this case. Let the organization assume responsibility for it, and let them take on the job of rooting out systemic pollution. Let the other owners come forward. We haven't seen them come forward as a group, have we now? No. So these are the kinds of political things that these guys don't get. And when poor Elgin Baylor was looking to looking for the folks to stand with him. Nobody was there. He didn't even get, people to talk about this issue. He was there, and the very same charges that he made all the way back then remain valid today, which means that there was validity to his lawsuit. But these guys who are now showing up and they're talking all this talk about, what we're going to have to do, and this is not your fight. You do not have a dog in this fight. When you had a dog in the fight, you opted out. So basically, you should have nothing to say. You can't now come around as a great moral presence. You should have nothing to say. You disqualified yourself. You were absent and unaccounted for when the battle to be fought was in fact being fought by one lonely guy. See, people miss this stuff. Now, I'm not a constitutional lawyer by any means, but I could imagine that anybody versed in constitutional law will have a lovely time with these so-called sanctions that have been imposed, being made to sound as if, well, the law has been written, so as Rio Brenner says, so let it be written, so let it be done. No, it's not going to remain final. The basketball commissioner may be powerful, but there are many holes in these sanctions that they announced yesterday, sounding very official and very, very severe. But somewhere in the back of my mind, I just don't accept things all the time. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I'm saying, well, they know that. Even as he's pronouncing these sanctions, he knows that they are contestable. The commissioner knows there's going to be a big fight that he may probably lose. But it bothers me when these guys, just the day before I played those tapes by Muhammad Ali, what a person with integrity sounds like. What a person with clarity sounds like. What a person with courage sounds like. No faking. Don't come now and talk, well, he's racist. He's been racist for a long time. Everybody knows it. Everybody knew it then. Everybody knows it now. But I'm not even worrying about that. Number one, the system's job is to fix itself. That's not the player's job. The system is committing, aiding, and abetting racism that is not the job of its victims and or would-be victims. Number two, when the fight was on, a real legitimate fight, you were nowhere to be found. So you cancel yourselves out. I don't place very much in your integrity of your argument now. You disqualified yourselves a long time ago because you failed to respond to a very legitimate lawsuit and a very legitimate reason to back up your fellow man, as it were. You were absent and unaccounted for, and you should be absent and accounted for in this hubbub that was created by the media, and you're going along with the line, and you're going to get hit. Believe me, it's going to come back to bite you in the butt. And that's for tomorrow. Talk about the biting in the butt. You want to keep it here. Coming up next is Jack Rasmus with Alternative Visions. Drop me a line, a note, at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrecht Lead. Thank you so much for being with me today. Bye-bye.